You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, is foreign intervention the only way forward for Syria? Foreign ministers meet in Brussels to debate their next step. We'll also be asking what stories to watch this week with Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield and hear from Sophie Grove about what's got people talking in New York. Plus, the Venezuelan conductor who's giving something back.
The Grammy is an honor for Venezuela, along with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, who made the recording, and of course, the orchestra system.
And the latest from the GSMA Mobile Technology Conference in Barcelona, and we'll also learn how secret codes are made and how they're unraveled. So lots to look forward to in the next hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Hamad bin Yasim Al Thani has said that the international community should provide arms to Syria's opposition, and Arab countries should take the lead in providing a safe haven for rebels inside Syria.
If you remember, this uprising in Syria now is 1 year. For 10 months it was peaceful. Nobody was carrying weapon. Nobody was doing anything. And Bashar continued killing them. I think they're right to defend themselves by weapon. And I think we should help these people by all means.
While the West has dismissed talk of a Libya-style NATO role to support the opponents of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Gulf Arab states have pushed for a more forceful stance. Indeed, Saudi Arabia said last Friday it would back the idea of arming rebels. Here, journalists at Britain's The Sun newspaper paid large sums of cash to corrupt public officials. Aware the practice was criminal, an inquiry into press ethics has heard today. Revelations that could prove damaging to Rupert Murdoch's media empire. Sue Akers is the Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the London Metropolitan Police. She said her investigation indicated Sun reporters had made multiple payments to police officers and public officials, including some in the military.
These are cases in which arrests have been made involving the delivery of regular, frequent and sometimes significant sums of money to small numbers of public officials by journalists. Some of the initial emails reveal that multiple payments have been made to individuals amounting to thousands of pounds. In one case, over a period of several years, this amounts to in excess of £80,000.
The phone hacking saga began in late 2005, leading to the jailing of a reporter from the News of the World and a private detective for illegally accessing the voicemails of royal aides and other high-profile figures. A gunman believed to be a student has opened fire at a high school east of Cleveland, wounding four students before he was taken into custody. Live television images showed emergency vehicles at the school and a scene of urgency as parents rushed to the vicinity to find their children. The students were brought to a nearby elementary school while they waited for their parents to pick them up. The shooter was believed to be a student. One mother praised high school officials for notifying parents of the incident immediately.
Of course, I was scared to death when I heard it, but it came through the automated system. I got a phone call on my home phone, my cell phone, my husband's cell phone, the emergency contact number, and emails. They've done a great job of handling the situation.
The four injured students were taken to area hospitals, but there is no immediate information on the conditions of those victims. The anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks has begun publishing more than 5 million emails from a US-based global security analysis company that has been likened to a shadow CIA. The emails snatched by hackers could unmask sensitive sources and throw light on the murky world of intelligence gathering by the company known as Stat4, which counts Fortune 500 companies among its subscribers. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange announced the haul during a news conference in London. And staying here in the UK, the family of an officer from Belfast who chose to go down with the Titanic have appealed for a benefactor to help return a letter he sent from the liner to his hometown. The two-page note sent by Dr. John Simpson, the assistant surgeon to his mother, days before the ship sank, is expected to fetch at least $50,000 when it is sold in New York next month. The family's hoping a generous donor will buy it and return it to Northern Ireland for public display. And those are the main stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan. And let's take a look at some of the headlines that are making the front pages of the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, our old favourite, the New Zealand Herald, and The Press. What have you spotted this morning? Well, it's pretty much obvious what's happening in Australia, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Shall we go for let's go with New Zealand first, just to cause confusion. So the New Zealand, the New Zealand Herald and The Press. Well, in the New Zealand Herald, the government controversially is saying that it was offering a cash carrot to get teenagers on the pathway to work, but the opposition say the so-called bribe won't work unless more jobs are created. Prime Minister John Key remains confident the economy will pick up and increase the number of jobs available, and he's offering an incentive, particularly for solo mums who find work before they are work tested, and they'll be able to keep their benefits for longer. It will fall by $100 a week until it disappears, an extra financial hand to help with the transition into work.
I do enjoy the idea of a cash carrot making the headline of a national paper. I haven't seen cash carrot being used before. And it is a phrase which I would argue is much underused in this parish, so you will be hearing more about cash carrots. What astonishes me about that story is that it's an incentive to get teenagers who've dropped out of school, to give them a financial incentive to get them back into full-time education as teenagers. It's a move that has just been removed by the British government, that is no longer possible. And now on the other side of the world, someone else is picking up the baton and picking up the carrot and running with it.
On a lighter note, the New Zealand Press talks about a musician called Brett McKenzie who will be, it's quite funny, he says 3.8 kilograms heavier when he returns to Wellington on cloud nine because he's got a golden Oscar statuette. The Wellington musician turned celebrity won Best Original Song at the 84th Annual Academy Awards yesterday for his ditty Man or Muppet. So he's very happy.
Brett McKenzie grinning with glee and happiness and triumph, no less, on the front cover of the New Zealand Herald as well. But we would be foolish to avoid the main covers of the
Australian
Sydney
papers,
Morning Herald and The Age.
Yeah.
Summed up quite brilliantly by a columnist on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald. This is obviously the aftermath of Julia Gillard and her thorough drubbing of Rudd in the Labour leadership contest that happened earlier on this week. Blood and spittle on the pub floor, bringing a filthy little fight between two Labour politicians, right down to its proper Aussie roots by saying there's blood and spittle on the pub floor. Kevin Rudd, his vengeful return stopped by a solid punch on the nose, like bruised scrappers in the aftermath of an ugly pub brawl. One wonders whether, in fact, giving them 10 pints of slightly nasty lager and making them fight it out would, in fact, have solved this problem a lot earlier.
Absolutely. But there's an even interesting angle in The Age, because they're saying that one of the key faceless men behind Julia Gillard's 2010 coup against Kevin Rudd has quit the ministry in Parliament in another shock to Labour, just hours before the caucus yesterday overwhelmingly confirmed that she'd won the leadership. So the person who was instrumental in
the
helping
kingmaker.
Her, he's quit. So what
he's
does
gone.
That tell you?
It tells you that it's still a big old mess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is, and it will go on and on and on.
And in fact, Kevin Rudd has now said that he will protect Julia Gillard from any third candidate who should have a go at her, and Kevin Rudd has also made a veiled pitch for his job back. He'd quite like to be foreign minister, saying he stood ready to serve the government in any capacity. But quite neatly summed up by the Sydney Morning Herald, Ms. Gillard said he would be staying on the back bench. A little reminder: you can read an interview with Kevin Rudd with Andrew Muller from Monocle in this month's Monocle magazine, which focuses very heavily on Australia. So do sort of have a look at that and bear it in mind when you're watching all the lovely little spats that are taking place over in Australia. The time now is 9 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time to get a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, in the west, over the next few days, we're going to see a lot of mild and sunny weather. The start of the week is a little on the damp side in the UK, Holland, Denmark and Germany, but this cloudy weather won't last for very long. Second half of the week, in southern France, it'll become so warm, even 20 degrees possible in Bordeaux. Great weather also across Iberia, across Monaco into the Swiss Alps. So let's take a look at the weather for Tuesday then, the city forecast. In London, 14 degrees and partly cloudy. Barcelona, 15 Celsius with sunshine. In Frankfurt, 11 degrees, rather cloudy here. And in Stockholm, 7 with sunny skies. North America now. The weather starts off good across most of the Atlantic coast this week. So from DC to New York, early Monday sunshine. In New England, perhaps some light snow Monday night into Tuesday. But then mid to end of the week, stormy weather will hit the northeast of the US. There could be some air travel delays as well, but that's still to come. On to Tuesday's city outlook. Toronto plus one, hazy sunshine. New York 10 degrees, sunny too. In Chicago 6 degrees and cloudy. In Los Angeles around 15 and sunny. Let's have a look at the southern hemisphere. In Sao Paulo 29 degrees, a good chance of thunderstorms here. However, if you're in Rio, the sun is out. Highs up to 35 degrees over the next few days. In Cape Town also sunny, 27. But you're in Sydney, get ready for downpours. From Wednesday, the weather is not looking great across most of New South Wales and Canberra too. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's Monday here, which means it's time to check in with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to hear what's happening in the world of affairs this week. Welcome, Steve. World of affairs, that sounds affairs. So lovely and naughty and rude and saucy.
It does sound slightly wrong, doesn't it?
Not wrong.
In our morning meeting, it's often referred to as Steve's affairs.
Wow.
Which, yeah, no, I'm not.
Do you actually plan out your affairs for the whole week? And the fact that you actually managed to have global affairs within a week is...
I know, global affairs.
I'm impressed.
It is, isn't it?
I'm impressed, Mr.
And these are affairs on three continents this week.
Where are we starting?
Okay, so there's an election theme to our global affairs look ahead this week. I'm going to start in Senegal. Senegal went to the polls yesterday. Senegal's a really interesting country. It's in West Africa. It's Francophone. They have had a good democratic history,
recent democratic history.
Stable place, isn't it? Abdoulaye who's the current president, came into power in 2000. At the time, he was a very popular opposition leader. Mm. He was also 73 years old then. And he was going
to...
This was in 2000.
Okay.
He was going to stand for just two terms because the constitution was changed just after he came to power, saying, you must only stand for two terms. However, now he's 85. He is... thinking maybe I would like to carry on. So he has changed the constitution or ignored the constitutional change and said, I'm going to stand for a third term, which has angered a lot of people, partly because he is nowhere near as popular as he used to be. The country is just as undeveloped as it used to be. There's huge problems with corruption. His son, Karim Wade, is widely disliked. And has become, because of the fact he's become a very influential figure within government. And many people believe that President Wade is trying to groom his son Karim as the man to take over from him. So, Abdoulaye Wade standing again at the age of 85 now for a 7-year term.
Right.
So, who knows? but there were many people that he was standing against, 13 opposition leaders. It's not likely that he's going to get the 50% that he needs to win outright. So it's probable that there'll be a runoff. But who knows? Two interesting things have happened so far. One, in terms of the election. One, when he turned up to vote yesterday, the crowd booed and jeered him.
They said, go home, old man.
Yeah, they did indeed. So that's not a good sign for him. And the other is that already the African Union observers who are there, led by Olusegun Obasanjo, who was the former president of Nigeria, are already talking about, well, look, if this becomes a little bit fractious, maybe we should have a coalition government.
You've already said that we've already established that this is a stable country, a good democracy, great elections since 1960. But this has been the first time that people have actually lost their lives due to this. There were demonstrations last year and people died.
Yeah.
And now there are thoughts that if it were to go to a runoff with his main rivals, Macky Sall, isn't it?
Yeah.
That there'd be a sort of an anyone but Wade group that would force him out, and there've already been demonstrations on this.
There have. I mean, I think having covered elections in Africa over the last 5 years or so, it never ceases to shock you when you speak to someone and they refer to their brother, their father, a friend who died during the elections. Mm. A phrase I've heard in Congo, in Zimbabwe, in Kenya as well. And there is a problem in a number of African countries that free and fair elections are still marred by or the potential free and fair elections are still sort of held up by the possibilities of violence.
They spill over so easily.
They have. And I think, you know, this isn't a peculiarly African problem. I think it's a problem where you have democracies that are still young and still growing, when there's lots of vested interests that don't want to lose power. And also when you have democratic systems that are very much winner takes all. If, you know, oppositions feel that, well, OK, if we don't get the presidency, we'll still have 40% of the parliamentarians and we'll still have some influence, then these things don't become quite so fractious. So that is something that we're going to see the results maybe later tonight, certainly by tomorrow, and we'll see how that plays out over the next week. Mm. Should we move on to another election?
Yes, yeah. Go on.
So Russia, again.
More rallies in the streets.
Exactly.
And internet base this time.
Exactly. So Vladimir Putin is hoping to become president once again on March the 4th. There have been a number of large protests against him. And the most recent of these was at the weekend. 35,000 people protested, mainly in Moscow. As you say, a lot of it organised over the internet. But what's interesting is that as, you know, we enter the final straight, Putin is becoming more popular. His ratings have crept up towards 60%, we're told. And this is partly because, you know, look, this is a guy who he has the control of the state media and the backing of the state media. And he is trying to push this line that he is the only one that keeps Russia stable, that his opponents cannot. And we've seen today with this allegation of, you know, a potential Ukrainian plot to assassinate him, which, you know,
is going to bring the whole question of national security into the forefront.
And it brings it into this whole issue of Putin is the only one to keep them safe. So, again, it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next 7 days.
There's always this thing, though, when you get to the Russian elections, that Russia will be the place where the political discussion takes place and where the protests have been very, very vocal in the last couple of months. Yet when you go into the smaller cities, they, like you have just said, will always rally behind Putin or behind the incumbent, because there is this need of stability from a central control, from a country which is simply so big. It's almost because of its geographical size, you could argue. You will need one central figure.
It's very dangerous to judge an election based on what's happening in a capital city. Mm. And I think there's a danger that in all elections that we do this, and certainly in Moscow. Should we move on to the US?
Very briefly, because I think we have Sophie Grove on the line in New York, who we'll come to in a moment. But Steve, we are going to have one more
very briefly
quick election
in the US.
Touch.
So Arizona and Michigan primaries this week, they're not important. The important ones are next week,
Super Tuesday.
It won't all be sorted, despite the fact we all thought it would be. All three of the main candidates, Santorum, Gingrich and Romney, are going to pick up delegates next week. This is going to run and run.
So the Romney campaign is expected to win, but it's not the end of the road at all, is it?
They will win, they will win, they will win. I've been saying that for a while. But it's going to be a long process.
They'll win messily and badly and unconvincingly.
And it won't help him against Obama.
What was that that little phrase you said about no one, you don't fall in love with them, you don't live with them?
So it's a very sort of old and hoary cliche in American politics, which says that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. The idea being that Democrats go, oh, we love this candidate even though he can't win. Mm. Republicans fall in line behind the one they won't. So far, the Republicans have not fallen in line, and nor have they fallen in love. We expect them to fall in line behind Romney. They're refusing to.
Thank you very much indeed, Steve Bloomfield. That's our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. And hopefully we can catch up with Sophie Grove in New York now. Sophie, a very warm welcome to Midori House. How is life in New York for you this afternoon?
It's wonderful, thanks, Emma. I'm here as a counterpoint to Steve's very hard politics.
We're going to be talking the hard issues of the Oscars, aren't we?
I know, it's a bit more fanciful, indulgent counterpoint. Yes, I've been having a lovely time. I was uptown last night watching the Oscars. I think I retired just in time to see Octavia Spencer sobbing over her trophy and completely losing it. But it was really interesting watching it on US TV because it's a complete circus.
I was about to say, what is we are treated to snippets overnight, which is obviously due to the time difference here in the United Kingdom. But obviously, if you're full on in the US, it must be really quite a jamboree.
It is, and everybody sort of found a TV, sort of lit a big fire and had dinner sort of actually just pinned to the TV, looking at, you know, just critiquing each frock as it came down the red carpet.
I was about to say, who critiques a frock? Because it is occasionally the preserve of the slightly snipey British press to have a go, you know, the winners and the losers. But does everyone just have a lovely time throwing buns at the television in the United States?
There is quite a lot of snarking and people, the claws are out as far as I could see.
who was out?
I mean, just in general, people, you know, there's lots of sort of you know, lovies sort of congratulating each other on how wonderful they look, but at the same time, people are really looking at to kind of diss each other's outfits and sort of say who is the most gorgeous and striking and who carried off their look and who sort of completely
there was a particular focus on this side of the pond of Angelina Jolie's right limb, her leg. Were you aware?
I know there was.
Were you aware of the Jolie leg?
I was. I thought she looked amazing. And Meryl Streep looked... She did look like she was sort of wrapped in sort of some sort of gold tinfoil.
She was.
She did look great as well.
She just run a long way and someone was going to give her a lemon.
I can't help it. I'm being catty myself.
No, that's fine.
But on the fashion theme, I've actually been doing some very important research, as you'll understand, in various shops around Manhattan.
It's a vital job. Thank you so much, Sophie, because I was getting worried. What have you been doing?
I know, someone's got to do it. And I've been on the front line of actually following up on a story that I've been looking at for a while about manufacturing in Manhattan.
Local manufacturing.
Sort of, local manufacturing and fashion and sort of the regeneration of the garment district. And it's so interesting. We just walked down the street just around the corner from the Monocle office and there's, you know, all of these amazing sort of factories that used to be here in the 30s. And, you know, Singer has this sort of 15-storey beautiful old building and it's all, you know, trendy shops now, but it's really interesting to see that some companies are moving their manufacturing back. And I've been in this wonderful shop which is actually kind of branching out here. It started in Williamsburg and it's called In God We Trust, rather Americana aesthetic, but it's beautiful. Everything's made in Greenpoint in Brooklyn. And it's just really nice to see that sort of homespun business, and you know, we've seen that you know, so many of the US designers have moved there, like, you know, Oscar de la Renta used to make stuff here in Midtown and they moved out, and it's quite interesting to see people who are actually thinking, no, we're going to move back and sort of cash in on that Americana aesthetic as well.
It has a very genuine feeling, does it, In God We Trust? If you can just see pictures of very, very sort of how do you describe it? Very, not necessarily retro, but very authentic. A very authentic take of sort of lovely handcrafted items and beautiful, you know, plain mannequins and very understated chic, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it's a theme. We've been speaking this morning to somebody who is called Joe Doucette, who's a designer. He was talking about the New York Design Festival that's going to be coming in 2013, and that kind of return to trying to understand what the Americana aesthetic really is and what that means for design and fashion. And so it's really nice to kind of tour around. Obviously, I've made some critical investments for the party tomorrow. We're going to having a fifth anniversary party at the British Consulate.
Will you be a walking personification of America, of authentic Americana?
I will be.
Good.
I will be. I'm doing my bit.
Thank you, Sophie. Thank you very much for joining us, and do keep us posted about the In God We Trust, the authentic Americana. It does look very beautiful. I want you to bring me something back, please. Thank you. That was Sophie Grove in New York. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. We'll be back after this short break. We'll be getting the latest on Syria then, so stay with us.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Hong Kong, Liv Lewichnik covers Southeast Asia.
From Hong Kong, I cover China, Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines and other Asian nations. And I also do stories in Australia from time to time. In Harbin, northeast China, I visited moon robot builders and Siberian tigers. And I popped over to Penang to check out the property market in Georgetown, a place that has the feel of 1960s Singapore to it. I love working from Hong Kong. It's a regional hub for commerce and finance that is taking leaps and bounds on the international art scene. It's got some of the best restaurants and shops around, and being one of the easiest places to start a business, it's a hotspot for startups. It's a city in fast forward, which is just the way we like it.
That was Monocle's Liv Lewicznik, our woman in Hong Kong.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and again how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
It's 25 minutes past the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. Activists now say the death toll in Syria's 11-month-long uprising has now passed the 8,000 mark. Almost 6,000 of those are believed to be civilians. And the Syrian forces launch a fresh offensive in the north of the country. Meanwhile, EU foreign ministers in Brussels have voted to impose tighter sanctions on President Assad's regime. These sanctions are that the assets of several government officials are now frozen, as are those of the country's central bank. There's also a ban on the purchase of Syrian gold, precious metals and diamonds. Well, to explain more, joining us on the line now is Sky's foreign editor, Tim Marshall, who's in Brussels. A very warm welcome, Tim. Just explain to us the reasoning behind these latest sanctions. We understand it's regime change is what's driving everything now.
Well, they never say that, but that is what lies behind things, because the stated position of all the EU countries is that President Assad must step down. And in order to persuade him to do that, they're not going to get involved militarily, and so but they are going for sanctions. Now, this latest round, there's two ways of looking at them. For example, some of the sanctions target individuals very high up in the regime. They can't fly to the any of the 29 EU countries. Assets over here are frozen, etc., etc., and that hurts them. And then there's other sanctions. For example, cargo planes can no longer land in the EU, and that targets the merchant class of Syria, much of which still supports the regime. But if they start thinking down the line in a few months' time, and that's the time frame, I'm now beginning to hurt economically. I'm blaming the government for getting me into this mess, they might start withdrawing their support for the regime. At that point, the regime concentrates its mind. Does it want to run away in an aeroplane to a country that will take it, or are they going to fight the last man? So that's why I think, you know, sanctions are sort of, sometimes people think they're wishy-washy. I actually think they are a tool of diplomacy designed to change the government in Damascus.
They are a tool of diplomacy, but and it, like you say, it does always raise the age-old argument that this will have potentially catastrophic consequences for civilians. We need only look at Iran at the moment, whose economy is in absolute freefall and people are really suffering as a result. I mean, how the way you described it was an incredibly neat sort of A follows B follows C way that in which to get rid of Assad, but are these really effective?
No. Look at Saddam Hussein, 15 years in power under sanctions. Although on that, in that example, what did was steal all the aid, any of the aid money that came through to help ordinary people, deliberately kept his people impoverished as possible and then told them it was the outside world's fault. Nevertheless, they didn't work. Another flaw in this is that I think it's around about 193 countries in the world, and I think about 45, 50 of them have got sanctions against Syria. So two-thirds of the world's countries are happy to carry on trading. And there's some very big countries, China, India, South Africa, Brazil, Iran. They're still going to trade it. So although they do get hurt, and although it does have an effect, I don't think when you're in a battle to death, which is what the Assad regime is in, I mean, it's all or nothing, they're not going to think to themselves, well, you know what, I can't travel and go shopping in Paris anymore. I think I'll just jack it in.
You mentioned there China. We always have to refer to both China and Russia as being the key blocking points in any further intervention in Syria. Do you think at any stage this will change?
No. Some of my colleagues have said to me recently, oh, well, you know, if international pressure on Russia became so much and the death toll climbed so high, the Russians would have to withdraw their support. Well, the Russian regime itself killed 60 to 80,000 civilians in its own country, Grozny, in Chechnya. I don't think they're really going to be bothered and flip entirely their foreign policy because, let's say, God forbid, 10,000 people die in Syria. They take a view for a number of reasons. One, they've got a warm water port, Tartus, in Syria. It's the only warm water port that their navy is allowed into. They're not going to suddenly switch sides, knowing that when they did switch sides, the Alawite regime of Assad would fall. It would be replaced by a Sunni-dominated regime, and that Sunni-dominated regime would not be a friend of Russia's or of Iran's. Because, you know, those are the big stakes you're playing for. Secondly, Russia, for example, takes a very dim view of preemptive UN resolutions. Last year, it believes it got burnt on Libya. There was going to be a theoretical massacre. I'm pretty sure there would have been one, but it was a theoretical massacre coming up in Benghazi. So they did not oppose the UN resolution, which took everybody to war against Gaddafi, with the subsequent outcome that we've seen. They're not going to go down that line again, because what they want is to reserve the right to handle an internal situation, i.e. Chechnya, in the way that they see fit. And the Chinese take the same view about Tibet. Now, you might not like this view, but it's a very real and a very hard view.
When you look though at Syria and the international reaction to it, you have the EU statement when issuing the announcement of these sanctions saying that Syria will be held accountable for their actions. And then tomorrow the UN Human Rights Council is going to hold an urgent meeting on Syria, neither of which, the Human Rights Council is not binding, obviously. One senses that there's a sort of an increased frustration among countries which can't actually get to grips with what's happening with the Assad regime. Yet you get countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar who seem to be more and more willing to engage in stronger intervention.
Yeah, and you have to ask yourself why. Different countries have different reasons why they want Assad out. Going back to the human rights issue, they're meeting in Geneva at the moment. They'll probably get some sort of thing through the Human Rights Council, which will condemn the Assad regime, and it won't make any difference at all. Much further down the line, it is possible, if history plays out in a certain way, that you would see members of that government in the Hague. Syria is not a signatory to the IRC, but you know, you can't rule that sort of thing out. But that's way, way down the line. But going back to the Chinese and the Russians, they're just not going to switch their geopolitical positions. Saudi and Qatar, well, they are not hitherto known for their commitment to human rights, especially the Saudis. So you've got to ask yourself, why are they suddenly so upset about what's happening next door? And then you start looking at a map of the world. To one side, Saudi Arabia has got Iran. It is a Shia government in Iran. They are Persians, they're not Arabs, and they are Saudi's biggest enemy. To the other side of Saudi Arabia, you've got Syria. And who is Iran's closest ally? Syria. Who is the government of Iran? Dominated by the Alawites, a Shia offshoot. If you knock over the Assad Alawite regime and replace it with a Sunni regime, you have suddenly weakened your greatest enemy, Iran. And I think that explains the Saudis' newfound concern for human rights.
Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on as always. That was Tim Marshall, Sky's foreign affairs editor, who's talking to us from Brussels.
Londonból, ez a Monaco 24.
Aus London, das ist Monaco 24.
De Londres, ez a Monaco 24.
De Londres, este es Monaco 24.
London kala, Monaco 24 desu.
De Londres, esse é Monaco 24.
Londonist, sino Monaco 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monaco 24.
Λόντζαδαν, μπουρσε, Monaco 24.
London kala, Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be hearing how the musical director of the LA Philharmonic, Gustavo Dudamel, has been giving something back to Venezuela. But with the time coming up to 26 minutes to the top of the hour, let's get the latest news headlines from Jonathan Wheatley. Jonathan.
Thanks very much, Emma. The Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Hamad bin Yasim Al Thani has said that the international community should provide arms to Syria's opposition, and Arab countries should take the lead in providing a safe haven for rebels inside Syria. Saudi Arabia said last Friday it would back the idea of arming rebels. Here, journalists at Britain's The Sun newspaper paid large sums of cash to corrupt public officials aware the practice was criminal. An inquiry into press ethics has heard today revelations that could prove damaging to Rupert Murdoch's media empire. A gunman believed to be a student has opened fire at a high school east of Cleveland, Ohio, wounding four students before he was taken into custody. Four injured students were taken to area hospitals, but there's no immediate information on the conditions of those victims. The anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks has begun publishing more than 5 million emails from a US-based global security analysis company that has been likened to a shadow CIA. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange announced the haul during a news conference here in London. And staying here, the family of an officer from Belfast who chose to go down with the Titanic have appealed for a benefactor to help return a letter he sent from the liner to his hometown, the two-page note sent by Dr. Simpson. The assistant surgeon to his mother days before the ship sank is expected to fetch at least $50,000 when it is sold in New York next month. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. It's 25 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, he made his name taking some of Venezuela's poorest children, nurturing their musical talents and turning them into a world-class orchestra. Now, the conductor, Gustavo Dudamel, who is the director of the Simon Bolivar Orchestra, but is now at the helm of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, has brought his former and current orchestras together for a remarkable performance. Together, the Simon Bolivar Orchestra and the LA Philharmonic performed Mahler's 8th Symphony in a concert that was broadcast live to movie theatres across the United States. From Caracas, Sarah Granger reports.
Hello everybody, I'm Gustavo Dudamel and I welcome you to my country, Venezuela.
He's been musical director at the LA Philharmonic for 3 years and with that orchestra recently won a Grammy for a version of Brahms' Symphony No. 4. Still only 31 years old, Gustavo Dudamel has also worked with Sweden's Gothenburg Symphony and the Stuttgart Radio Symphony Orchestra.
I would love that you join us in this amazing adventure together with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Simon Bolivar Symphonic Orchestra of Venezuela, and a choir of more than 1,000 people.
More than most other young musical stars, he owes his career to Venezuela. So he came to Caracas to give something back. Before the historic performance of Mahler's 8th Symphony, Dudamel spoke to the press in his native Spanish.
The Grammy is an honor for Venezuela, along with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, who made the recording, and of course, the orchestra system. That's the most important thing. All the honors, the awards and recognition are for our system.
The system that he's talking about was created in 1975 by Venezuelan musician José Antonio Abreu. A nationwide network of orchestras and choirs, it offers children too poor to pay for music lessons the chance to master an orchestral instrument, be it violin, oboe or trombone. Along the way, they learn teamwork, discipline, and self-respect. The system's been rolled out in several other countries, including Scotland and Japan. It's one of the country's greatest exports, according to Venezuelan arts journalist Ángel Gómez.
As a journalist, I've traveled with the musicians from the system to various places, Vienna, Milan, Berlin, and I've seen how people react. These are audiences with musical traditions that stretch back thousands of years, and they die for what this orchestra is doing. It's as if you're in a Ricky Martin concert and not a classical music event. But it's not a miracle. The orchestra understands performance. They'll turn the lights out for a costume change, then play the mamba and throw their jackets into the audience. They understand it's a spectacle.
Dudamel is the system's greatest product and one of its most vocal advocates. And beyond Venezuela, he's been a gift to the world of classical music, a young, approachable conductor who's often greeted as if he were a rock star. The concert recorded in Caracas will be shown again in US theatres on the 29th of February. For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
We'll be right back.
Mahler's Eighth Symphony there, being played by both the Simon Bolivar Orchestra and the Los Angeles Philharmonic, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. Well, after this short break, we'll be getting the latest news from the GSMA mobile phone conference, including a connected car which will plan the route to your next meeting. Stay with us.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops, from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. The time is 19 minutes to the top of the hour. Well, the mobile phone industry has all its eyes trained on Barcelona at the moment. It's the annual GSMA Mobile World Congress this week. Roughly 50,000 decision makers from the industry have gathered to unveil their products and discuss the next step for innovators. All this minus Apple, of course. Top of the agenda is a so-called connected car, which is promising to get rid of all the traffic jams. To tell us more about this and everything else that's been happening at the conference, David Phelan, that's Monocle's technology correspondent, is at the event in Barcelona, and hopefully he joins us on the line now. David, a very warm welcome to Midori House. Tell us about Bill Ford Jr.'s connected car, for starters.
Sure. Yes. Well, he is speaking right at this moment, Bill Ford, about connected cars, and this is a first in itself to have someone from the automotive industry talking at Mobile World Congress, because it's so focused on mobile phones and now tablets and so on. And we'll see what he's talking about when he's finished, but it's expected that he'll really big up the connected car, which is more than just having your iPod able to talk to your car's speakers. It's a way that your car in the future, the very near future, Ford says, will be able to talk to cars all around it. So you will know, your car will know how near the nearest car is, so it can adjust its speed, and a cruise control can be a subtler and more effective thing if it knows that it's not going to crash into a car right in front of it. Or I think what they're really looking forward to is a situation where the phone can talk to the car, so your car will know what your next meeting is going to be before you drive to it, so as you step into the car, the sat-nav has already planned out your best route.
So simplified, this is what Bill Ford has said, that cars will now become pieces of a much bigger and richer communications network.
Yes, I think Ford, among other car manufacturers, are very keen to put a mobile phone technology into their cars so that, yes, exactly as you say, it becomes part of a connected network. And the really interesting stuff comes when you connect your car via the mobile network to the infrastructure around you, so that a car park could tell you where the nearest vacant parking space is and direct you straight to it. Or even if, say, you're driving around Los Angeles and it's a particularly smoggy day, providing you've got the information at the mobile phone's fingertips and therefore at the cars, it can drive you away from the smog and into the clearer air.
There's also the idea that the car can actually take over your driving for a little bit of a time, so that you are unlikely to, so your car fits in more smoothly with the traffic flow. Now, on paper, that sounds utopian. In practice, that sounds vaguely chaotic if one person has got their connectivity going and the other one hasn't, and you know, the potential pitfalls are huge, but surely, I mean, but he's obviously selling this as the way forward.
Yes, you're right. It sounds perfect and terrifying in the same moment, and obviously, as you say, every car has to have that system to be able to work, and I think this is more futuristic. It's theoretically you're heading to a world of driverless cars, but I'm happy to say that seems to be some way off.
There also seems to be the converse idea that not only do you gain the information and take advantage of this connectivity, surely the authorities will be able to predict who's likely to run a red light or who's a, you know, this is more of a monitoring system on drivers as well.
Yes, I think we're still at a very early stage, so joyously people aren't able to pin down those very important details yet.
So what else has been happening at GSMA? What's the atmosphere like today?
It's been pretty busy, I can tell you, wandering around the seven major halls of Mobile World Congress is a slow process. It's crammed with, as you say, decision makers and journalists and every kind of mobile connected person. But it's been very interesting. There have been very few tablets. I thought there were going to be a lot more tablets announced. Not altogether surprising because it's likely that Apple will announce the iPad 3 next week, and Apple never comes to shows like this. So I think companies are abiding their time. Although Samsung announced a 10-inch screen tablet called the Galaxy 10.1 Note, which comes with a very finely tuned stylus and Adobe Photoshop Touch photo manipulation software built in, so that you can do really pretty advanced things on your tablet with photographs and then press a button and send those photographs to people who are doing the same thing on a computer. It'll change, I think, the way people interact with their photographs, and Adobe also made that software available for iPad users today.
Is it a genuine game changer, or is everybody still playing, waiting for the iPad 3 to come out and then to go back to their drawing boards again?
I think Samsung's use of the stylus is very important and I think could be a game changer, but I think you're right. Mostly, there have, as I say, been few others announced because everyone will want to know what Apple's doing next, and then they can plan their response to that. And that is so near, it's no surprise that they haven't really made their thoughts public yet.
One thing that has been doing the rounds today is Nokia's latest phone, which has got a 41-megapixel camera, described as pretty chunky, heavy, and what can you do? You can blow up a photo to a billboard-sized poster, is that right?
That's right. It sounds like a typo, 41 megapixels, but it's right. It has quite a big sensor, a square sensor, so actually you'll never get the full 41 megapixels out of it. And you don't have to. You can take a regular 5 megapixel or 8 megapixel shot with it. And it is very chunky. Of course, the problem with a bigger sensor is the lens has to be a slightly greater distance away from it for the focal length to work. And so this has got an enormous bulge on the side of it. Even so, it's not that big a phone. And it does mean that you can take very big photographs. One of the big problems with a camera phone is you don't have an optical zoom because there's just no room for it. And the idea here, I think, is that you can use a digital zoom, i.e. crop the photographs, really to a tiny portion of them, and you'll still have enough pixels so that you can blow the pictures up pretty big.
Where are Nokia trying to establish themselves in the market here? Are they trying to launch the ultimate smartphone in terms of photographs, or are they trying to replace our beloved SLRs at home? What are they trying to do here? Because it's going further and further away from a communications device.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, I think, because the other key element of this phone is that they haven't used Windows Phone 7, their newly adopted smartphone operating system for it. They've used Symbian, which is a fairly aging system that they are still supporting, but it's not cutting edge by any means. So it feels like they're planting a flag to say, look what we can do, and maybe they'll bring the technology into their more high-end phones later on, because this is not an expensive device. I think they'll sell it for €450, they say, which, you know, is much cheaper than an iPhone or something like that. So it feels more like an experiment than anything else. But I have to say, it's quite a fun little device, and it does take remarkable pictures.
Will it re-establish Nokia's position in the market? Because all we've read about in the last couple of months is obviously it's losing battle against Google and Apple, and the fact that it's no longer going to manufacture mobile phones in Europe, it's going to send them all over to Asia.
Sure. I don't think it will do that. I think it's, in a sense, that's not the aim. I think it could be the aim when they take this technology and put it in their Windows Phone handsets. Nokia has had a big success with its Lumia 800. It made it, in the last few months, the most successful Windows Phone handset you could buy in terms of sales. That's not saying that much compared to sales of Android or iPhone, but it is a big step forward for Nokia, and it is something of a bounce back for them. So if they can employ that technology in the camera technology in their Windows Phone handsets, this could be quite something.
David, as always, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, before we delve into the world of code breaking, let's have some music. This is Hopelessly Hopeful by Yanita.
Hopelessly hopeful. But it's not over yet.
That was Yanita here on Monocle 24 and Hopelessly Hopeful. We turn now to the story where code breaking was brought down because the person who wrote the code was simply too nice. A hitman has just been jailed for 25 years in the United Kingdom. Kieran Bryan was sending coded messages to his sister while in remand, asking her to bribe someone he'd attempted to kill. A code expert was brought in to decipher his numerical scrawlings and said it was the repeated use of the word please that gave him away. But where do coded messages come from, and how do you write or decipher one? Well, joining us now on the line is Simon Singh, the author of The Code Book, A Secret History of Codes and Code Breaking, and someone who I understand, Simon, has actually seen the hitman's numerical code. Is that right?
Yes, well, it's been a nice news story today, so it's been all over the press. It's a type of code that essentially is called a substitution cipher, where you replace a letter with a different letter or a different symbol, or in this case, numbers. It's a little bit more complex than that, it appears. And so it took the code breaker, a chap called Dr. John Olson, a while to crack it. But you mentioned one thing there, that it was the politeness of the code maker that gave him away. The police, when they interviewed him, the chap who was convicted today, pointed out to the code breaker that he was very polite. He used the word please and thank you several times. And that helped the code breaker, because he looked in the message to see if there were sequences of numbers that might relate to the word please. And sure enough, there were. That's called a crib. And once you've got a crib like that, you can use it to kind of crowbar open the rest of the message.
I'm assuming then that if we were to boil it down to something so simple, just looking for a repeated pattern is all we need to be able to break a code. Is that right?
Well, the simplest substitution codes are often broken by something called frequency analysis, which is a pattern, as you suggest. Every letter in every language has a specific frequency. So in English, I think it's about 13% of all letters are the letter E, followed by T being the next most common letter, then A, and so on. And if you look for the most frequent numbers or symbols, you can then relate them to the frequencies of the letters you would expect. This was a trick that was developed about 1,000 years ago in Baghdad by an Arabic philosopher called Al-Kindi. He wrote the oldest known manuscript we have on code breaking.
So where do we find the origins of codes? Because obviously you've just referred to something that dates back 1,000 years. This is, many of us would obviously would more readily associate code breaking dating back only pretty much as far as the Second World War. But obviously this is tracing back millennia.
Yeah, I think as soon as you have something to write down that's important, you want to protect it. So that might be, we have pottery glazes, recipes for pottery glazes going back several thousand years, which are encrypted. Military messages, personal diaries. The Kama Sutra has a technique for encrypting secret love letters. So this goes back, as you say, millennia, to almost the birth of writing, I suppose.
Simon.
And I think the other thing just to mention is it comes right up to the modern day. We live in the information age. Information is all around us. Our databases, our medical records, our e-commerce, all thrives on information. So today, encryption and codes are more important than ever before, because without that information being protected, our lives and businesses would just fall apart.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That's Simon Singh, the author. We're out of time now for this Monday's edition of Midori's House. Today's show was produced by Katie Bilboa. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. In 3 hours' time, it'll be time for the Monocle Daily, that's at 2200 hours, with Andrew Muller and Daniela Pallid. So do join them then. But from here, all of us here on Midori House, goodbye.